Well, this is a character which has been in the Marvel comics for some considerable time, but this is the first time that she's been in a film, which is still to come out. And it's a Mossad operative, former Mossad operative. It's said that in response to the criticism that there's been over this, that they've rolled back a little bit on the representation, and they are now supposed to be showing that she is drawn by one of the other superheroes to see the effects of Israeli aggression on a Palestinian child. And this makes her more thoughtful about the human rights abuses that might be carried out by the Zionists. Mm. So there's an attempt to sort of soften the image of the Mossad superhero, if you like, and to show that there are some criticisms permissible of the Zionist state, but only some. And that, of course, is the point here.
Yeah. I mean, Matt, I mean, are these connections between Marvel and Israel significant, do you think? And what do you make of it?
Well, I certainly know that the connection between the Department of Defense and the CIA and Marvel are significant. I'm less knowledgeable about the links with Israel. But you've got to remember that the United States is such a massive industrial entertainment juggernaut that it dwarfs any other nation's ability to control media. And that's particularly the Department of Defense, which can rewrite scripts extensively and has done. The one of the headline findings that we've had is that, you know, there are perhaps 10,000 different products that have been affected over the past century, but with a huge escalation over the past 25 years in terms of cooperation with the U.S. military industrial complex, if you also include organizations like the FBI. It's really quite a shocking amount of control that is exercised by the American security state.
Interesting. Well, tell us a bit more about the relationship then between the United States military and Hollywood.
Well, the US military has quite a lot of power over Hollywood producers because they can offer things like aircraft carriers and Black Hawk helicopters and a lot of advice and just long-standing links in all sorts of different ways, so that they can exercise leverage over many, many scripts. And this happens, as you've already stated in your report, this happens on a lot of the Marvel films, but also over things like Transformers, and basically almost any film that you ever see the military in the script has been combed through by the US military. It also often happens with the CIA as well, although to a much lesser extent, but still on very prominent products, such as the film depicting the search for Osama bin Laden, for example. And then there are other films as well, which may not have actually had Department of Defense or CIA or FBI support, but nevertheless still, and these are in some ways perhaps the most interesting films of all, films that haven't actually had script rewrites, but are still ideologically aligned to state interest. And it's interesting when that happens. I mean, in the case of representations of Israel, an interesting one from many years ago is the Spielberg film Munich in 2005, which did something, yeah. I guess, similar to what David's talking about in this new Marvel film, which I've not yet seen, so I won't comment on in any great detail. Yeah. But Munich did something similar in that it was softening Israel's image by showing the humanity of the people who were involved in an assassination program against Palestinians. Now, does that, you know, how you want to interpret that as a political product is up to you. But it's certainly, if you are humanizing people who are doing illegal things, yeah. In the same way as if you are humanizing American soldiers in Vietnam,
yeah.
You take that as you will.
Yes, yes. I mean, David, I mean, I guess the collaboration between the United States military and Hollywood isn't overly surprising, really. But I mean, what about the way in which the Israeli military is depicted by Hollywood?
Well, I mean, I think you've got to look at this in the round. Of course, what everyone says is that the US is the greatest ally of Israel. That Israel is sort of the lapdog or the Middle Eastern watchdog of US imperialism. And of course, when it comes to the representation of the military, then you'll see the kind of input made by the Department of Defense also having an effect on allied military. So, you know, the US is the leading force in NATO, so British Army and other NATO forces will be more positively represented as a result of those kinds of influences. But the Israeli military, of course, is not widely seen outside Israel as being an overly abusive force. And in terms of the way in which they're represented in films, you don't have much of the way of those representations. But you can see that the way in which, for example, Israeli series, television series, which represent, for example, the CIA, are imported into the West. And there are attempts there to show a kind of a humanised, sanitised version of what the Israelis are up to.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, though, isn't it, that Marvel produced films like Black Panther, didn't they, actively aimed at the black community in the US, and yet they've got strong links with Donald Trump within the company. It's a curious sort of comparison there.
Yes, I mean, it's a kind of moderate attempt to bring in a black audience while at the same time not really properly representing either organizations like the Black Panthers or liberation movements in the Global South. So yeah, it's a sort of calming down of the edges and an attempt to say that actually there's an audience here.
I mean, Matt, I mean, has Hollywood produced many other films that overtly promote intelligence agencies from other countries?
Mainly, I mean, the James Bond series obviously leaps to mind because the MI5 and the Department of Defense has been involved in that series. And that, again, wasn't really known until the 21st century. But they've been involved in at least half of the Bond films, and which has involved script rewrites. They did for instance, they threw out a joke in one of the Bond films about the US losing the Vietnam War, for example. And they also changed the identity of one of the kidnapped admirals to make sure that he wasn't American. They think they made him Russian in the end so that it didn't reflect badly on them. So there's all sorts of promotion of American institutions and by implication and by extension sometimes also MI5. I don't think it happened. I mean, I think American filmmaking, the politicization of American filmmaking tends to be very American, if you like. I mean, they're not really looking to, promote the intelligence agencies of Britain directly or of the French or anything like that. But it tends to be very much more in-house about the representation of the CIA and Department of Defense. And part of the reason for that is that it's not just about propaganda in the normal sense. And it's not just about promoting an American view of history. It's also about recruitment. They want to recruit people for the US military and also for the CIA. In fact, one of the reasons that they got involved, the CIA in particular, got involved in filmmaking was because they were underrepresented in terms of diversity, particularly in terms of women, for example, in the 1990s. So they needed to get into that. And that's why they did series with people like actresses, stars like Jennifer Garner, to make products like Alias. And that was to promote women into the agency. So it's more about the American experience. At least from my research, more about the American experience.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Matt. Let's just pause there for a moment and have a look at this report on how a cache of leaked Sony emails offer a revealing insight into Zionist influence on Hollywood.
The relationship between Israel and key Hollywood figures was blown open by the WikiLeaks exposure of emails belonging to Sony employees. A litany of lobbying activities was revealed being organized through official company emails. At that time, the Sony Pictures Entertainment CEO, Michael Linton, was revealed to be having dinner with then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the invitation of famous film producer and Israeli spy Aaron Milchan. Films like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, 12 Years a Slave, Fight Club and Big Mama's House are some of Milchan's best-known works. he has publicly admitted running 30 different companies in 17 countries for Israeli intelligence.
Milchin detailed how he was recruited in the 1960s to Israel's Bureau of Scientific Relations, where he helped gather technology to further Israel's still unacknowledged nuclear program, saying, quote, "I did it for my country, and I'm proud of it." Milchin moved to Hollywood in the 1970s, but he suggested his efforts on behalf of the Israeli government didn't end completely. Milchin indicated other big Hollywood players were also involved, saying, quote, "When I came to Hollywood, I detached myself completely from my physical activities to dedicate myself to what I really wanted, filmmaking. But sometimes it gets mixed up."
Former Israeli President Shimon Peres says of Aaron Milchin, "Aaron is a special man. It was I who recruited him. When I was at the Ministry of Defense, Aaron was involved in numerous defense-related procurement activities and intelligence operations. His strength is in making connections at the highest levels. His activities gave us a huge advantage, strategically, diplomatically, and technologically." Following his warm meeting with Netanyahu, Michael Linton went on to become the chairman of Snapchat and then Warner Music Group. The emails also reveal a campaign to get legendary British filmmaker Ken Loach banned from the Cannes Film Festival by pro-Israel film producers. Ben Silverman, former co-chairman of NBC Entertainment and Universal Media Studios, and producer of shows such as The Office, argued that Hollywood must boycott Loach for his pro-Palestinian views. Ron Rothals, producer of well-known hip-hop film classics like Paid in Full and State Property, rages in an email to the head of Cannes Film Festival that there's no place for Loach's intolerant and hateful remarks in a global world of film and filmmakers. The campaign against Loach was led by Ryan Kavanagh, CEO of Relativity Media, a company responsible for financing more than 200 movies, who acknowledges meeting with officials at the Israeli embassy to discuss the issue. Perhaps the worst aspect of the emails is the mobilization that takes place to support Israel when it bombed Gaza, killing around 2,400 people in 2014. It included hip-hop legend Russell Simmons asserting that he will begin lobbying for Israel, and the email checks former Israeli commander Kobi Marom inserted into it to assist the rich and famous in their efforts to support Israel.
David, what about the content of those Sony emails that WikiLeaks revealed? Quite interesting, isn't it?
It's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, when you see attacks on people for alleged anti-Semitism, you often imagine, you know, there must be people behind the scenes talking to each other, but you don't usually get the emails, you don't usually have the leaks. In this case, you have the leaks, you have the email chains with them discussing how to sabotage the possibility of Ken Loach being given an award. I mean, it's really extraordinary. These are people who are not Israel lobbyists, they're not people who are directly members of Israel lobby groups, but they are people who have contacts. There are people with connections to the Israeli intelligence services. There are people who are ideologically aligned, yes, and they speak to each other and they plan and they plot and they get together through emails. And these emails are the evidence of that, that's what they do. This is not something which is made up as a Jewish conspiracy. These are Zionist supporters who collaborate together, and the evidence is in this email cache. And it's really quite instructive to see how that works. And of course, that must be the way it works in many other cases too.
Yes. I mean, Matt, this character, Michael Linton, who was mentioned there, is also on the board of the RAND Corporation, which is a US military think tank. So what do you make of his meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu?
Well, I certainly know that the RAND Corporation has also actually been involved in filmmaking before, including the Hollywood blockbuster film Red Dawn, which was about the Soviet invasion of the United States. That was a 1984 film, but then it was remade in 2012 with the Chinese being the villains, and North Koreans being the villains. So Rand has also been involved in filmmaking, has guided those kind of narratives. So I think that's probably quite instructive for the for what kind of meetings they would have been. It's interesting about Ken Loach. I mean, Ken Loach is about the least hateful person I can think of. He's a very gentle old soul. I often see him down at Bath train station. I've met him yes. and interviewed him briefly at Bath Football Club. He makes all of these, you know, peace-nicked films. He's really should not be the subject of that of those kind of attacks. He's a voice for peace.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, I've met Ken well, and yeah, a lovely guy, and certainly doesn't deserve the opprobrium which has been poured all over him. But David, I mean, what's your opinion of Arnon Milchan and his activity for Israel?
Well, again, here's another example of someone who is recruited for the Israeli intelligence services for a very obscure intelligence agency, which is mentioned there, that Bureau of Scientific Services, and who conducts many 30 different operations or 30 different companies he said he was involved in, and then who goes off to do something else, in this case, filmmaking. And he says, but of course, you know, when I was doing filmmaking, the intelligence stuff got a little bit mixed up with that. So the people who are ex-Mossad or ex-Unit 8200, the Signals Intelligence Agency, they're not really always ex. Sometimes they go on and do other stuff because they've got the contacts.
Yes.
And they're perfectly happy in yes. many circumstances to pass on information, to be part of networks, and to have an influence beyond their involvement technically in the intelligence agencies. Now, we've seen in this programme many, many occasions when there are people who've been involved in the Israel Defense Forces, the Israeli military, or in their Israeli intelligence firms, companies, and raise the question about whether this is an issue. Well, we know from the Sony case, these are certainly issues.
No, indeed. I mean, Matt, the campaign against Ken Loach that you mentioned there, I mean, was ferocious, but ultimately it was unsuccessful. I mean, why do you think that was? Because since then he was expelled from the Labour Party for refusing to denounce people like David and me, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always a struggle, isn't there? And ultimately, the truth can out. And people like Ken Loach have had a lot of... have got a strong constituency of... and also a strong middle-class constituency, which, you know, the English middle class is a useful bunch of people to be backing you, I guess. And also, he's been working since the 1960s. You know, his first film being Pez, you know, award-winning film... and then a whole series of products. And he's not just a political figure. He is also a cultural figure. So I think that helped. He is part of civilized society and has been a major part of people's lives. So it's an indication that these kind of fights can be won.
No, indeed. And I mean, of course, and that's encouraging that, you know, they're not all powerful. And, you know, it's good to see that, you know, Ken was able to prevail in those circumstances. But finally, David, I mean, I see that the music mogul, Russell Simmons, is hoping to lobby for Israel. I mean, what else do we know about the Israel lobby's activities in the music industry?
Well, we've touched on the Zionist influence in Hollywood today.
And
earlier in the show, we mentioned the Creative Community for Peace, an organisation set up by the Israel lobby group staff for us, which is involved in the creative community, which means, yes, the film industry and the media industry, and indeed the music industry. In previous shows, we've also looked a little bit at the music industry and the involvement of the Zionists in the music industry. And it's extremely strong influence there, because that many of the big music companies are run by Zionists. Mm. And it's an extraordinary thing to say, but they then are engaged directly in things like the Creative Community for Peace, or indirectly they have foundations which fund the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, the Jewish National Fund, and all sorts of other organizations which are involved in ethnic cleansing in Palestine. So these are significant issues in all the way through the entertainment industry, not just in relation to music and not just in relation to hip-hop.
Mm, yeah, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time again. And I'd just like to thank David, obviously, as our resident expert for joining us today, and obviously Matt joining us from Devon. Thank you for joining us as well today. And we'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing. I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing. They do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
We are here to discuss about ethical development today. But before we enter ethical development, Professor Nakavi, I would want you to give us another brief account of worldview of development.
So, as we mentioned previously in one of the sessions, that when we talk about the development of the ideology, ideological development, we are talking about the development of the worldview, the understanding about the universe. It's a cognitive understanding. It's understanding through cognition. Therefore, cognitive development is very important.
Yeah.
If I have been able to develop, my child has developed that cognitive faculty and is able to realize what is true and correct and make the proper judgments and reach the proper conclusions, is able to logically rationalize things. That is very important for the development of the worldview.
Okay.
Of course, we believe that within us, naturally, Allah Almighty has created this fitrah in us. We have this inherent fitrah, divine fitrah, the divine nature of mankind. With that breathing of the soul of Allah Almighty, by birth, by virtue of being a human being, we are inclined towards perfection and the absolute being. That
exactly.
is Allah Almighty. But to realize what that perfection and absolute being is,
it takes efforts.
It requires this cognitive understanding.
Okay.
To be able to channelize this understanding which is there deep down in us, in okay. our very natural birth, in our very nature, intrinsic in our human nature, is godliness.
Okay.
We know God, we love God. But till it comes out in the form of a comprehensive worldview, you cannot consider that to be, you cannot be assured of the fact that we will abide by that worldview. We shall remain committed to that worldview. So we need cognitive development to make a proper worldview.
Yeah.
And then, so that is cognition.
Okay.
But then when we want to have faith about that worldview, there emotions also come into play.
All right.
So emotional development is required for the development of the faith in the worldview that we have, because we may be able to rationalize and philosophize the fact that God exists, that he has these attributes, he is the creator, he is our Lord, he is to be worshipped, he sustains us at each and every moment of our existence. There's no doubt about that. Philosophically, rationally, we can deduce that. But do we have faith in that? That is important.
That's important.
As a result of that worldview, is the love of Allah Almighty being, you know, is it going into that direction of our understanding?
All
or
right.
Our love and hate are deviating from that? So the emotional development is important.
Is playing a part over there. Well, we'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi and we're talking about ethical development. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you gave us a brief of worldview development. You said cognitive development about the worldview. When we realize in that our ultimate goal is to reach closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, emotional development takes a part in because faith is involved, and when there is faith, there's emotional development as well.
And we were talking about the fact that actually, whatever, as we mentioned, deep in our hearts, there's only one thing which has to be loved. The object of our love is Allah Almighty. But that does not negate our love for our parents, does not negate our love for our siblings, it does not negate our love for our children, because the love of these things emanates from the love of God. It should come out of that fountainhead. So emotions have to be channelized and managed according to that worldview. And then this worldview has to be changed into ideology and values and things which are valuable to us in the sense that they are actions or things which have to be performed. For example, one of the basic values, apart from the fact that we have faith in Allah Almighty or we have faith in Allah Almighty or we should have faith in Allah Almighty, we have to carry out things which are good according to Allah Almighty's creation or His legislation. For example, worshipping Allah Almighty, being obedient to Him, is a value which emanates from the fact that He's our Lord.
Yeah.
So worldview changes into ideology, or it is translated into ideology, and we are committed to that we have to worship Him, we have to obey Him, not only in the sense, in the specific sense of worship that we carry out in prayers, but worshipping Him and obey Him in all aspects of our lives. And therefore, this ideology, what is good and what is bad, what is evil, what is good, wrong and right, evil and good, this
love and hatred.
And love and hatred according to these things which are valuable.
Yeah.
Love should come towards Allah, and things which are have to be carried out, what ought to be carried out because of our belief in Allah Almighty, then our love and hatred should get channelized into the actions which are based on these values. So ethical and moral development is the understanding of what is good and what is bad.
And when parents are reading that aloud in that ziyara, inni salmul liman salamakum, that develops that I love what you love. And
we need to inculcate in them, in our children, that look, goodness, evil is something which is inherent, as we believe, as Shia Muslims. We believe that goodness and evil are inherent in actions.
Yeah.
And Allah Almighty makes them obligatory because they have inherent goodness. An action is good because it is based on justice.
Yeah.
An action is evil because it is based on
oppression
and tyranny. So the love for these things emanates from the love of Allah Almighty.
Exactly.
And this is where ethical and morals are developed.
Yes. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqavi and we're discussing ethical development. Yes, Professor Naqavi, you said love, the concept of love, the concept of hatredness, what is good, what is evil. This is all developed and in a child and it comes in the ethical development. And now I would want to ask you about the behavior. How do we teach our child how to behave, how to show your ethics as Muslims?
So behavior is managed by the laws that Allah Almighty has legislated. What we talk about, when we talk about fiqh, when we talk about ahkam, practical laws, we are talking about those norms which have to be followed practically, so that those ethical principles are strengthened in us. I mean, these ethical values which are there as a part of that worldview, and then the practices which come as a result of those values are managed or controlled or regulated by the ahkam. So we need to teach our children the ahkam.
Okay.
The laws, the practical laws of worship and interacting with other human beings.
There and so how many, to interact, basically.
How to interact. There's a vast, this is a very vast subject.
Yeah.
Practical laws about worshipping Allah, practical laws about dealing with other human beings, transactions, business, sports, and everything, every human action has is controlled and regulated by Islamic laws. Islamic laws, when you practice those laws, those values within you, the attributes, the godly attributes within you are strengthened.
Yeah.
So they, and as a result of that, your faith in Allah is strengthened.
Yeah.
So this is, it works in a loop.
Yeah.
Worldview leads to faith. Faith leads to taqwa and commitment to those values. And taqwa leads to actions, behavior, which are regulated by fiqh. And there, physical development is comes into play, because many of our actions, even worship that we carry out in the form of prayers, the physical faculties have to be intact to carry out so many things.
And in a very playful method, we can teach them very divine things, like, you know, there are parents who say to their children that, if you get me this thing, I'll give you one chocolate. If you give me more things, if you help me more in the kitchen or if you help me more in cleaning the room, I'll give you two chocolates. In the same way, we can teach a child that if you start your conversation with salam, and if you're the starter, you'll get, there are these many rewards for the one who starts it and there are these many rewards for the one who answers it. So you're basically teaching your child here how to be very, very down to earth. And as a Muslim, one has to be down to the earth. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. If you have any questions, any suggestions, any comments for our program, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. And when you go to our official website, parstoday.com, you'll find a tab, Call of Islam. Over there, you can find our programs. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. We are proud that our faith has retrieved the Quran from the ceremonies and saved this holy book, which is the best prescription for liberating human beings from all physical, mental, and intellectual chains, shaking their hands, feet, hearts, and minds, and dragging them toward non-existence, destruction, slavery, and subjugation under the taghutis and oppressors.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the prayers. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that never neglect the Friday and daily congregational prayers, for they are the political manifestation of the prayers. In this part of his speech, obviously, he's talking about the congregational prayers, the importance of that, whether it's a daily or the Friday. And the main idea we see that in Islam, that everything is been said to be performed in a group. In the society, you need to socialize with the people. We know that there are many people who are afraid to communicate with others, who may be shy to go in the community to talk to the people. There are some shy people in the society. But Islam is saying that you need to communicate with the people. You need to socialize among the people. Even if you want to pray five-time prayers, it is better to go to the mosque. And it is said that the reward of the prayers that has been done in the mosque in the congregational, it has more reward than when some person does it individually. Or maybe sometimes it is said that if the number of people in that jama'ah, if it increases the specific number, then even the angels cannot count the number of rewards which has been given to each one of them. Therefore, Islam is a religion that takes everyone in a united state, and it wants everyone to help each other. It wants everyone to go with each other, to help each other, and offer prayers together. And yes, there are some individual prayers which is recommended, but that is for the person itself. But the main prayers that we have, the daily prayers, the Friday prayer, they all are in jama'ah, they all are in a group. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu alayhi. Imam Khomeini is also saying that never neglect the Friday and daily congregational prayers. The negligence of such thing will take us away from the right path, will take us away from the society. When we are not meeting people, we don't know what they need. We don't know what is going on in the society, what society is talking about, what are the important things in the society that we need to take care of, what are the issues, what are the affairs that we need to take care of. Or maybe if I can help someone, if I'm living individually, I might not meet people. But if I can do something, it is in my strength, and I'm going there and I'm meeting people, I'm helping them, I'm helping the society. And in order to have a peaceful society, a society going towards the perfection, we need to pay attention towards the Friday and daily congregational prayers, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the social and political crisis in France. But first, this brief analysis.
France has been experiencing social and political crises of various forms for at least the last 10 years. But one would be hard-pressed to know this from watching Western mainstream media. Only when the French state began to brutally suppress the continuously held yellow vest protests, including the deployment of the French military to the streets of all major cities, and the use of munitions, resulting in the loss of eyes and limbs among protesters, did many realize the gravity of the situation. EU-mandated austerity policies imposed by the two traditional political parties in their respective administrations, following France's cult-like commitment to European integration embodied in the Lisbon Treaty of 2009, resulted in the collapse of the two-party dominant system of socialists and Gaullists, which had existed in France since the 1960s, a system which created a reasonable level of political representation for the poor and working class in the French state. The far-right nationalist currents and parties gained many disgruntled voters from both sides, and out of this mess emerges a wondrous media gestalt with minimum qualifications, called Emmanuel Macron, supported and sponsored by the French billionaire elite, to be crowned the youngest president in French history. Macron was made leader of a new neoliberal political organization that continues where the two older parties failed the EU to forcefully implement all the EU-mandated austerity measures. When confronted by opposition in the French parliament, the young president rules by the significant decree powers that the constitution of the Fifth French Republic grants the president. In this process, dismantling the French social welfare state, which had been the basis of social stability in France since World War II. There is an ominous contradiction between the positive image of France that's portrayed in the billionaire-owned media and the negative reality on the ground among the average population. A reality which occasionally rips through the fake media imagery when Macron is slapped, booed, or pelted with rotten fruits when he's forced to step out among the rabble during election seasons. There doesn't seem to be a political party or movement currently in France who's offering solutions to the basic historic and structural problems that France is facing. Media propaganda, rule by decree, and when necessary, sending the military into the streets are the methods of rule that the French elite and oligarchy have chosen in the last years in order to forcefully end the French social welfare state, contrary to the wishes of the overwhelming majority of French citizens. The Fifth French Republic is itself the result of the social, political, and economic upheaval that France experienced in the 1960s following the loss of its empire and the devastating Algerian War of Independence. It remains to be seen if the Fifth Republic will end in social turmoil and upheaval just as it began.
Author and journalist Ramin Mazahedi, thank you for joining us on Insight. We want to have a nice conversation about France and what's going on in France. You've been there for many years now as the Press TV journalist. You've also recently written a book about the Yellow Vest movement, which was a social movement there in France, which I was hoping that you could maybe also talk about that a little bit and all the events that are happening in France. Let me begin our conversation maybe with this introduction. We see that France is basically going through a very long period of turmoil, of political instability, which, you know, obviously when you have this kind of political instability, it's probably rooted in some sort of a social and economic instability. We see that the two main political orientations of parties, the Gaullists, the Socialists, which were dominant in the Fifth French Republic, and we can also talk about historically the different republics that have existed. We see that, you know, since at least 2017, with the coming of Emmanuel Macron, that these kind of political parties and movements, the traditional ones, have also kind of changed. There's new movements. There's the kind of so-called centrist movement that Emmanuel Macron, who was at one point part of the Socialist Party, entered the politics with that movement. We see the rise or the reinvigoration of the nationalist movement under Marine Le Pen, who is the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen. So there's a lot of things going on in France. And as somebody who spent a lot of time there and who studied it deeply, we would want you to, in this program, maybe give us some of your own insight into what's going on in France. So what's going on in France?
Well, like you said, I mean, I've been there for 13 years, and I have a certain point of view that's unique to the daily hard news reporter. I think this is what our listeners can kind of benefit from. It's great to have academics. It's great to have think tanks. It's great to have different mm-hmm. types. So the daily hard news is sort of... It's a different perspective because every day you're looking at the news and you have to make a decision that day. You have to make a judgment on, was this policy good? Is this policy working? This bill, is it working? Did this politician deliver on what he just said?
Right.
And To go back to your main point, I can tell you from on the ground reporting, you know, you were talking about the two mainstream parties in France. They are totally smashed. They are totally discredited with the average person. Mm-hmm. It's over. It's right. Finished for the Socialist Party. It's finished for the Gaullist Party in whatever form, you know, you right. want to call them. Sarkozy, Macron. Macron, as being a centrist, that is smashed as well. Right. He was never a centrist. He was always a right-wing politician. Mm-hmm. He was a Gaullist minus the love for France, minus the patriotism. And that's basically what the two mainstream parties have become. They are no longer pro-France parties. They are pro-EU parties. Mm-hmm. This is something that I think many people don't understand, and many people don't understand in France, and even the Yellow Vests don't understand. And that's this concept that since 2009, since the forced installation of the Lisbon Treaty, mm-hmm. which became a part of the very foundation foundational texts of the EU, of the Pan-European project, Europe has drastically changed. Mm-hmm. We are talking about very, very different things. It's a brand new era across Europe in France. And what that means, and even the Yellow Vests, who are so politically intelligent, they don't understand this. France, this guy right here, Macron, does not have control over his currency, over France's budget, over France's skies, over France's rails. So many things. Right. It's a brand new Europe. And the Yellow Vests provide a sort of capstone to the end of the era of European social democracy. The EU is the assassin of social democratic measures. The idea that, well, we don't want socialist central planning, we don't want socialist total equality, but we do want social security, we do want some, you know, unemployment insurance. This era, it was called in France the 30 glorious years from 1945 to 1975. Mm-hmm. That is what in Europe, what neoliberalism is trying to end. That's what the EU is there for. And what I can, you know, to just go back to what I was saying about how being a daily hard news journalist on the ground, the benefit it has is I can report the Yellow Vests were only 15-20% worse in terms of how they were repressed than in 2016, 2014, 2010. There has just been, since 2009, you know, as my book shows, as it relates, the Pan-European project has totally failed to bring prosperity, democracy, and stability. And the Yellow Vests are the outgrowth of that. And we can focus on Macron, but Francois Hollande, his right. predecessor, was just as bad. Sarkozy was just
as bad. Because we have to remind our viewers, he was the industry minister. Emmanuel Macron was the industry minister Hollande, and Hollande was a socialist.
Right.
And we see all across Europe this idea that these socialist parties, who traditionally were supportive of the working class, we don't want to exaggerate, but as you said,
Social Democrats, particularly
after World War II, in most European countries, the working class, those who are, you know, workers or lower level employees, there was a level of political representation that they had within the political system of Europe.
Limited, but there.
But there was there. And the basic standard of living was they were capable of maintaining that basic standard of living, and maybe even a little bit higher than that in terms of education, in terms of social mobility, all those things that are considered, you know, positive things.
Leading among the world, yeah. You know, but in the European social safety
net. All that has gone now in Europe.
It's all gone. It's all gone.
In all countries that you look around Europe, those socialist parties basically became neoliberal parties in the 90s.
Right.
Whether it was in Austria, whether it was in Germany, whether it was in Britain with Tony Blair. And
that's
and
when it became totally confirmed. In France, it was with François Mitterrand's U-turn, his infamous U-turn, elected in 81 on the most leftist program in West European history.
Exactly.
83 U-turn. And it's the way that, and my book talks about this, the way that French elites have been captured by neoliberalism, but the average person has not.
Exactly.
And that's unlike in the U.S., in the U.K., the average French person is committed to ideals of egalitarianism, certain reductions on individualism, and they protested in mass numbers in 95, and then everybody in Europe starting in 2009, every spring was an anti-austerity protest.
Exactly.
So the rest of Europe kind of, you know, caught up with France, but we see with the Yellow Vests how the French are always taking it further. they are so politically enlightened, and we are going back to 1789. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, put them on a higher level, but you look at 1789 and the way that it fought against monarchy, autocracy, oligarchy, aristocracy, and then liberalism, the way that liberalism has failed in two centuries of French history, and we see it now with the European Union, the way that Western liberal democracy has failed to bring what they were asking for in 1789, egalitarianism, equality, fraternity. These, just as monarchy has failed, so Western liberalism has failed. Mm-hmm. And the Yellow Vests, they just, God bless them, they don't really understand this. The idea that the Pan-European project has failed. So they had a list of 42 different demands that...
The Yellow Vests.
The Yellow Vests. Not one of them mentioned Europe. Not one of them...
Right. So let me see if I understood you correctly. So we have a couple things that are happening at the same time. We have this giving away of national sovereignty under the title of European integration.
Yes.
So basically every country we see now after this process happened in the late 90s in many other countries, mm-hmm. And then, as you mentioned, culminated in the Lisbon Treaty.
Precisely.
We have most countries regretting that, most of the population of many of the countries, not the elites, regretting that they gave away that sovereignty in the name of European integration. Now, we have to go back and also mention that at that time, when the issue of European integration was happening, the main argument was, well, we have a history of war in Europe, so let's give that nationalist sovereignty, let's give away some of that, and we will have this peaceful, you know, lovely Europe where it's all one and we're all together.
Yeah.
But it ended up ended up happening is you had basically the tools being taken away from national governments to make social and economic policy that is relevant.
Precisely.
So
we are relying on Brussels to be social democratic,
which they're obviously not going to do.
They're obviously not.
So we have this one movement. I'm trying to just summarize what I heard from what you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, we have this idea that those traditional left-wing socialist, social democratic parties, which were supposed to represent the interests of normal working class people, they had that neoliberal turn, as you said. Mm-hmm. You mentioned France. We could also mention Austria in the 80s. The Social Democratic Party being run by a banker. We could talk about then later on Gerhard Schröder in Germany with the Hartz and the Hartz IV, the program to cut Social Security. We could talk about Tony Blair, of course. So we have all this.
All over the West, like what you're saying.
Right.
I mean, we can go through every country and point out all over the West, which was never a revolutionary culture, almost never. I mean, France was 1789, but they didn't succeed. It's not a place like Iran. It's not a place like China. It's not a place like Cuba. It's not like Eastern Europe.
Right.
Western Europe and the Anglophone countries, it never took hold. Elitism has dominated. Liberalism, which is basically just aristocracy, rights for those who can afford it. Yeah, I mean, you know.
What I was going to say is that then what ends up happening is a lot of these working class, they start voting for right-wing nationalist parties.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have a situation, because we talked about the idea that in France we have a kind of a withering away of those two main orientations, the Gaullists,
which, totally discredited.
You know, the so-called mainstream conservatives,
totally.
and the mainstream socialists. You suddenly see a huge rise in the nationalist parties in France, in different countries. So if you could talk about that a little bit too, the idea that you have this working class feeling, I'm not talking about all of them, mm-hmm. but the idea that you have significant portions of the working class who used to vote for socialist parties suddenly now voting for nationalist parties, with the idea of immigration and migration and all those hot topic issues being raised for being exploited in terms of electoral power.
Who's making this a hot topic? I mean, in France, in between the presidential election of this year and the legislative election, the biggest news was the burkini, a long bodysuit so Muslim women can go to the beach. Nobody cares about the burkini.
Right.
But the 1%, the oligarchy, the people who control French media, you know, it's about six billionaires control something like 80%
right.
of all their media. It's this nonsense. It's this right-wing liberalist nonsense that you see all over the West, where this is what the Yellow Vests fought against. The Yellow Vests, one of their absolutely primary achievements was to put the issues of the working poor back on the agenda.
Right.
You know, people who make too much money to get, you know, any of the West's small social safety net, but they don't make enough that they can lead a stable life. Right. The working poor, liberalism from 1789, all throughout history, since then, with the exception of what the French call the 30 glorious years, right. 1945 to 75, the era of social democracy, West